Did Viau conclude that the greater good of the church would be served with Luciani's death? Viau's behavior after the Pope's death was either that of a man who was responsible for or deeply involved in that death, or of a man suffering a severe moral crisis. He destroyed evidence. He lied. He imposed a vow of silence on members of the papal household. He rushed through an embalming before a majority of the cardinals had arrived in Rome, let alone been consulted. If Viau is blameless with regard to Luciani's death, then after the fact he most certainly materially assisted whoever was responsible. His actions and statements ensured that someone got away with murder. He himself clearly had a motive. It is also clear he had opportunity. In addition, by dint of his position as Camerlengo, he had virtually total control over immediate subsequent events or, as in the refusal to perform an official autopsy, non-events. It may well be that Viau's various illegal actions after the discovery of Albino Luciani's body were motivated by what Viau considered the paramount factor, the greater good of the Catholic Church. That is, if he saw clear evidence of murder, clear proof that Albino Luciani did not die a natural death, he may have acted to protect the Church. Many believe that this was the case. Even given that rationale, however, I would still contend that at the very least, morally, Viau appears to have been in need of help. Well, again, the theological factors here notwithstanding, basically setting those aside, I should say, it is obviously clear that, as Al Yalop has pointed out, that Viau's behavior in and about in and around the time of the death of John Paul I was very, very, very suspicious. It is of more than passing significance here, we believe, that this very same Cardinal Viau was intimately connected with Vatican Incorporated, the same Vatican Incorporated which was involved with the Mafia, which was involved with the P2, an explicit fascist organization with links going back to Mussolini and the Nazis, and involved in all sorts of bloody activities, as we're going to see, and the very same Vatican Incorporated with the investigation of which, and whose the investigation of the machinations of which had produced all of the corpses that we've looked at: Sindona, Calvi's secretary, judges, police chiefs, and so forth, as well as some of the people who actually wound up pulling the triggers. So the intended move by John Paul I against Vatican Incorporated and Cardinal Viau's connections to Vatican Incorporated and subsequent role in the apparent cover-up of the death of John Paul I merits serious consideration here.
Now, while we're talking, and I hope I'm recovered from my coughing fit here, while we're talking about possible suspects that David Yalop talks about in God's Name, one of them, of course, has to be Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, if you're putting together a scenario for the murder of Pope John Paul I. Of course, anybody involved in the murder of John Paul I would almost have to be, or any person who would organize such a thing would almost have to have keen inside connections in Vatican City. But of course, he's talking about Marcinkus, whose connections inside Vatican City are obviously as good as they get, especially as we will find out, since he can't really leave anymore. Again, reading from the book. With regard to the murder of Albino Luciani, Marcinkus had the motive and the opportunity. Among the many functions he performed for Paul VI was that of personal papal bodyguard and security advisor. His knowledge of the security arrangements, such as they were, was unsurpassed. Exactly why the president of the IOR, and by the way, that is Paul Marcinkus, he means, was wandering around Vatican City shortly after 6:30 on the morning on which Albino Luciani was discovered dead has yet to be established. Research indicates that Marcinkus was not, as a rule, near the bank premises at such an early hour. Unlike Viau, he did not live inside the Vatican walls, but at the Via Strich in Rome. Marcinkus brought many facets to his work in the Vatican Bank. Not the least of these were his elements of his early childhood in Al Capone's Cicero, Illinois. Quote, "How are your gangster friends in Chicago, Paul?" was a running joke in the early 1970s. It was heard less after Sindona's trial. It is not heard at all since the Calvi debacle.
So, but Marcinkus, one of the people, obviously, who stood to lose from Albino Luciani's investigation of IOR and moves against it, just happens to be walking around in the vicinity of the papal apartments at 6:30 in the morning, the day that Albino Luciani is discovered dead, and at this very time, Cardinal Viau is in the apartments tidying things up for the public. Again, consider the fact that he was not only the Pope's bodyguard and was intimately, Paul VI, that is, bodyguard, and intimately familiar with Vatican City and all of the secret passages therein. There are some 30 secret stairways in the Vatican, pointed out by Yalop later in the book, or earlier in the book. But it should be noted also, perhaps, that Paul Marcinkus, it was also the bodyguard for Pope John Paul II when he was shot. So Marcinkus, a man very much around when the corpses begin hitting the ground.
A pretty lousy bodyguard, you'd have to say, right?
Well, unless his job is to guard just the body and not the life supposedly contained therein.
There you go.
At any rate, concluding, now obviously, Albino Luciani was not able to move against the Vatican bank, and the events concerning Roberto Calvi, the Ambrosiano tangle, Marcinkus, these all happened after the death of Pope John Paul I. Now, Pope John Paul II, Carol Wojtyla, the first non-Italian pope, basically canceled all of the proposed reforms that Luciani had in mind. On the contrary, he not only canceled them, but many of the people, including and especially Paul Marcinkus, had their power increased by Carol Wojtyla. Of the resolution of these events, David Rialop writes in the conclusion of In God's Name, by September of 1982, Marcinkus, who had never left the Pope's side during his visit to Britain in May and June, had become a virtual prisoner within the Vatican. He was replaced as organizer and advance guard of international papal trips. To have ventured out of Vatican City would have been to invite immediate arrest by the Italian authorities. Marcinkus continued to function as head of the Vatican Bank, and he declared that the Vatican did not and would not accept any responsibility for the $1.3 billion that had just disappeared. I would add, keep that in mind, because we're going to see refutation of that here in just a second. The fact that the Vatican was not responsible, obviously we've seen that they were. The Roman Curia refused to accept judicial papers that the Italian government attempted to serve on Marcinkus and others at the Vatican Bank. Protocol must be observed at all times, the Curia insisted, even when the theft of over $1 billion is involved. The papers would have to be handed to the Italian ambassador to the Vatican. Vatican City did establish a commission of inquiry after a great deal of prodding from the Italian government. Simultaneously, the Vatican Bank's own lawyers busied themselves with an inquiry. The Italian government had also created a commission of inquiry. By now, there were jobs for nearly everyone. The lawyers working for Marcinkus came up with their conclusions first. One, the Institute for the Works of Religion had not received either from the Ambrosiano Group or from Roberto Calvi any monies and therefore does not have to refund anything. Two, the foreign companies indebted to the Ambrosiano Groups have never been run by the IOR, which has no knowledge of the operations carried out by the same. Three, it is established that all the payments made by the Ambrosiano Group to the aforementioned companies were made prior to the so-called letters of comfort. Four, these latter, by their date of issue, have not exercised any influence on the same payments. 5. In any future checking of the facts, all of the above will prove to be true. I have already established that these Vatican facts are very far from the truth, Yalop picking up here. The commission of inquiry set up by the Vatican has yet to report. Its conclusions were due at the end of March 1983, then the end of April 1983, then August 1983, then October, then November. By the way, they finally came out in 1985. The commission comprises four wise men. Two of them, by their presence on a commission of inquiry that Cardinal Casseroli had predictably called objective, completely invalidate any findings that may eventually be reached. One is Philippe Devecq, the former chairman of UBS, the Union des Banques Suisses, Zurich. Devecq still maintains very close links with the UBS. This is the bank that holds on behalf of Licio Gelli $55 million of the stolen money. It is the bank that holds on behalf of the late Roberto Calvi and Flavio Carboni over $30 million of the stolen money. It is the bank that holds on behalf of Carboni's Austrian mistress, Flavio Carboni is a business partner and associate of Calvi, by the way. It is the bank that holds on behalf of Carboni's Austrian mistress, Manuela Kleinzig, $2 million of the stolen money. And I would also interject, we're going to come back to the Union Bank of Switzerland in a later broadcast. Continuing. Philippe Devecq is also the man at the center of what the French call the sniffer planes affair. This involved a wonderful invention, the brainchild of an Italian technician Aldo Bonassoli and Count Alain de Villegas, an elderly Belgian. The invention came in two parts, one housed in a plane that beamed back information to the second part on Earth. Cross-sections of the geological strata many thousands of feet below the Earth's surface were then seen as technical data on a computer screen. The potential was limitless. Along with instant mineral and oil prospecting at a fraction of the traditional cost, there were also military implications. Any eye that could locate oil thousands of feet below the Earth's surface could also pinpoint a submerged nuclear submarine. Encouraged by President Giscard d'Estaing, the French oil giant ELF poured $120 million into the Count's Panamanian company, Fisalma. Villegas was the sole shareholder, and the company was administered by Philippe Douek. By the time the French realized that le sting had been played on them, $60 million had vanished. Duvec told the French that the money had gone to research and charitable works, unquote. One of the men acting for UBS Zurich who had been keeping an eye on this pioneering work in the art of international theft was Ernst Keller, who at the time was also a shareholder of Ultrafin AG, a Calvi-owned company linked to Ambrosiano Holding Luxembourg. Ultrafin was the conduit by which the Count's Panamanian company ultimately received its initial payments. Another member of the Vatican Commission is Hermann Abs, who was head of the Deutsche Bank from 1940 to 45. The Deutsche Bank was the Nazis' bank throughout the Second World War. Abs was, in effect, Hitler's paymaster. During this period, Abs was also on the board of IG Farben, the chemical and industrial conglomerate that gave such wholehearted assistance to Hitler's war efforts. Abs participated in board meetings of IG Farben at which members discussed the use of slave labor at a Farben rubber plant located in the Auschwitz concentration camp. And I would interrupt that it, as we looked at in our broadcast last week, the Pope himself was a, quote, slave, unquote, at that very same camp, or one of the IG Farben slave labor camps in the vicinity of Auschwitz, so it's therefore questionable whether a man who was a slave would hire the man who had enslaved him to help handle his finances. Continuing with Yalop's account. No matter how many ex-bank chairmen or Nazi paymasters the Vatican employs, the truth will not go away. At least $1 billion in the monies owed to the various banks is the Vatican's responsibility. Perhaps the greatest irony of all is that no matter how much or how little the Vatican benefited from the phantom companies littered in Panama and elsewhere, it owned the companies when the debts were incurred. In fact, it has benefited vastly, but if the banks that are owed money are really determined to get it back, then they have only one logical course of action. Sue the Vatican. More specifically, sue the Vatican Bank and Pope John Paul II for 85% of the profits, from the bank go directly to the Pope. At the time of Calvi's death, he was, according to subsequent sworn statements made by members of his family, negotiating with Opus Dei, which had agreed to buy the 16% of Banco Ambrosiano that the Vatican owned. If this deal had been completed, the $1.3 billion hole would have been filled, Calvi's empire would have remained intact, and Archbishop Paul Marcinkus would have been removed from office. Many, including Marcinkus, objected to that 11th-hour deliverance from such a quarter. Now, with Calvi dead, the Vatican has been wrangling with the Italian government and a consortium representing international banking for nearly 2 years. Eventually, in February of 1984, news that agreement had finally been reached began to filter out of the Geneva conference rooms. By mid-May 1984, the details were clear. The international banks will get back approximately two-thirds of the $600 million they had loaned Calvi's Luxembourg holding company. Of that, some $250 million will be paid by the Vatican Bank. The Vatican is due to hand over this sum on June 30, 1984. This payment is being made by the Vatican on the basis of non-culpability, unquote, but in recognition of a moral involvement, unquote. The reader may care to re-examine the Vatican denials of any involvement recorded on page 322 in light of this impending repayment. This amount represents a loan made to the Vatican by Calvi's Peruvian bank, where there can be no possible dispute of the debt. The faithful should ignore the appeals that will undoubtedly be made in Roman Catholic churches throughout the world. All the Vatican Bank is doing is repaying a part of the vast amount of money it acquired through the activities of Calvi and Marcinkus. And still, the Vatican Bank has walked away from the entire affair with millions upon millions of dollars that represent a substantial amount of the still missing monies. At the time of this writing, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus still clings to office. He has been written off many times, yet he still survives. He still hides in the Vatican, afraid of being arrested by the Italian authorities in the event that he emerges. Word has reached me that Marcinkus recently appealed to the Italian courts asking for immunity from prosecution. I hope that before the Italian judiciary considers Marcinkus's plea, they obtain access to a still-secret report of negotiations between Italy and the Vatican City-State on the Ambrosiano bank failure. Possibly the most extraordinary information the report contains is the revelation that the secret and criminal agreement between Marcinkus and Calvi made in August of 1981 was not, as the Vatican would have the world believe, a singular aberration by a kindly archbishop toward a devout Catholic banker. Rather, the report will show that other similar agreements were made between the two men dating as far back as November of 1976. The criminal conspiracy, therefore, began during the reign of Pope Paul VI. These facts serve to underline powerfully what would have occurred if Albino Luciani had lived. Also hiding within the Vatican are the Archbishop's colleagues and partners in so many crimes, Luigi Menini and Pellegrini di Strobel. In such a manner does Pope John Paul II preside over his Vatican Bank in May of 1984. While all three men remain fugitives from Italian justice, the authorities have sequestered all Italian property belonging to Manini and Destrobel. All three are wanted by a wide range of Italian authorities in a number of cities. Yet another colleague, who would have also been promptly removed by Luciani if he had lived, Monsignor Donato De Bonis, the secretary of the IOR, is hiding within the Vatican walls from Turin magistrates who are investigating a $1 billion tax evasion scandal. De Bonis, who has had his passport withdrawn by the magistrates, continues, like his three colleagues, to work at the Vatican Bank. In such a manner does Pope John Paul II, to whom these men are answerable, preside over his Vatican Bank in May of 1984. Cardinal Ugo Poletti, P-O-L-E-T-T-I, the Cardinal Vicar of Rome, is another man that Luciani had decided to remove. In his case, too, there is ample evidence to illustrate the wisdom of Luciani's decision. Poletti was responsible for recommending to Andreotti, then Prime Minister, that General Raffaele Giudici, G-I-U-D-I-C-E, should be placed in command of the finance police. In this capacity, P2 member Giudice organized the $1 billion tax evasion scandal, diverting massive amounts of money to Licio Gelli. In 1983, Cardinal Poletti indignantly denied using any influence to get Giudice his job. The Turin magistrates then showed the Cardinal Vicar of Rome a copy of his letter to Andreotti. Poletti remains Cardinal Vicar of Rome. In such a manner does Pope John Paul II preside over the Roman Catholic Church in May of 1984. Well, several points to be made here very quickly, because the time is drawing to a close here. A commission was set up to supposedly investigate Vatican finances. The people on it are highly suspect. Two of the people, Philippe Devecq, and who is the other person that they cited as being totally... Philippe Devecq, and also... Who's the other person?
Cerari or Cerruti?
Yes, Cerruti, okay. Were two of the people very close to the Vatican Bank. Cerruti was close to the Vatican Bank, but beyond that, Philippe Devecq, a person who is holding much of the stolen monies of Licio Gelli in his account at the Union Bank of Switzerland, to which we're going to come back. Also note that Nazi banker Hermann Abs, who put forth the venture capital to build the slave labor camps at Auschwitz, as another person who winds up on this commission. Of course, Pope John Paul worked in some capacity or another at one of those very same camps. And it's also worth noting here that an organization called, and hearkening back to our discussion of fascism in the Vatican last week and remembering the fascist nature of P2, which is at the core of all of these Vatican bank machinations, it's worth noting that a fascist society called Opus Dei, and that is not an inaccurate or biased description of that society, a society called Opus Dei has been moving up very dramatically in the Vatican under Pope John Paul II.
Yes. Lest anybody think that it has been anything other than business as usual after the death of the 33-day Pope John Paul I, yes, we're going to look at Opus Dei very briefly for our last article, and it also is going to kind of point up some of the things we're going to be getting to next week when we get into the international connections in earnest. Okay, again, last segment from In God's Name by David Yallop. On July 25th, Albino Luciani had written on Opus Dei in Il Gazzettino, the Venetian newspaper. His remarks were confined to a short history of the movement and a discussion of some of the organization's aspirations toward lay spirituality. Bear in mind, too, as we're talking about the rise in the Church of Opus Dei, that Opus Dei is a lay organization. In other words, it's not made up of ordained priests, but of laymen. As to the more controversial aspects of Opus Dei, Luciani was either ignorant of them, which is unlikely, or was yet again displaying his sense of quiet discretion. With the election of Carlo Votila, quiet discretion has become a rare commodity. His espousal of Opus Dei, this is John Paul II, of course, his espousal of Opus Dei is well documented. In view of the fact that this Catholic sect shares many views and values with a corrupt P2, and that Opus Dei is now a force to be reckoned with inside Vatican City, a few basic details are in order. Opus Dei is a Roman Catholic organization of international scope, though its actual membership is relatively small. Estimates vary between 60,000 and 80,000. Its influence is vast. It is a secret society, something that is strictly forbidden by the Church. Opus Dei denies that it is a secret organization, but refuses to make its membership list available. It was founded by a Spanish priest, Monsignor José María Escriva de Balaguer, in 1928. It is part of the extreme right wing of the Catholic Church, a political fact that has ensured that the organization has attracted enemies as well as members. About 5% of its members are priests. The remainder are laypersons of both sexes. Although Opus Dei has members from many walks of life, it seeks especially to attract those from the upper classes, including young professionals, with potential to rise to positions of power. Dr. John Roche, an Oxford University lecturer and former member of Opus Dei, describes it as, quote, sinister, secretive, and Orwellian. It may be that its members' preoccupation with self-mortification is the cause for much of the news media hostility that has been directed toward the sect. Certainly the idea of flogging yourself on your bare back and wearing strips of metal with inward-pointing prongs around the thigh for the greater glory of God might prove difficult for the majority of people in the latter part of the 20th century to accept. No one, however, should doubt the total sincerity of the Opus Dei membership. They are equally devoted to a task of wider significance, the takeover of the Roman Catholic Church. That should be a cause of greatest concern not only to Roman Catholics, but also to everybody else. Under Pope John Paul II, Opus Dei has flourished. If the present Pope is not a member of Opus Dei, he is to its adherents everything they could wish a Pope to be. One of his first acts after his election was to go to the tomb of the founder of Opus Dei and pray. Subsequently, he has granted the sect the status of a personal prelature, a significant step on the journey to Cardinal Cody land, where one becomes answerable only to Rome and God. The organization has, according to its own claims, members working on over 600 newspapers, journals, and scientific publications scattered around the world. It has members in over 50 radio and television stations. In the 1960s, three of its members were in the cabinet of Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, helping to create Spain's economic miracle. The head of the huge Rumasa conglomerate in Spain, José Mateos, is a member of Opus Dei. He is also currently on the run after disclosures concerning the network of corruption he built, a network not unlike that of Calvi. Opus Dei is massively wealthy. José Mateos alone has funneled millions into the organization. A considerable amount of the money from Mateos came from illegal deals with Calvi, perpetrated in both Spain and Argentina. P2 paymaster and Opus Dei paymaster. Could this be what the church means when it talks of God moving in mysterious ways?
So again, under Carol Waitola, not only are all of the proposed reforms that Luciani was undertaking shelved, but many of the people, including Marcinkus, move up in power, although obviously the Ambrosiano scandal has basically confined him to Vatican City. All of the other people continue to work for the Vatican Bank, even though they would be indicted and arrested by the Italian authorities if they were able to get their hands on them. And under the Pope, who worked at one of the slave labor camps around Auschwitz, an explicitly fascist lay society, Opus Dei, is moving up rapidly in its power within the church. It's also worth noting that Opus Dei was very much involved with the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile. They played a key role in that. That basically winds things up, but obviously it's 1 minute to midnight, so we really haven't got time to sum up much of anything to pass what we've been doing. Again, this pretty much concludes the second of our five-part series. Let me very quickly give you the DAVCOR address right at the end. All of our archive tapes, including the five-part Pope Shooting series, are or will be on file at a tape duplication service. The name is DAVCOR, D-A-V-K-O-R-E. They're located at Suite 1300D, as in DAVCOR, Space Parkway, three words just like it sounds. That's in Mountain View. Zip code is 94043. The phone is 415-969-3030. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. And once again, DAVCOR, Suite 1300D, Space Parkway, Mountain View, California, 94043, 415-969-3030.
That's right. And those of you out there who are listening to this tape, or actually listening to the live broadcast even, especially, may think that you have heard everything there is to hear about Vatican corruption. Wrong. Wrong, wrong. We have barely begun to scratch the surface of this incredible tangle, and the story just gets more and more bizarre, and the plot just gets thicker and thicker. So next week, be with us. Next Thursday at 7 p.m. when we come up with part 3 of the Mediterranean merry-go-round. We're going to play a song, and then we're going to sign off for the night. So we will see you next time on Radio Free America, broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
I get money from you to tickle your whim or blow up your mind. Then I give money to you and you pay me back in kind. Now I gave money to you. Joe, 'cause Bill said he knows he'll pay me back in time.